Thank you. It's a pleasure for me to speak at Michael's birthday. And Michael and I discuss a lot of math and physics, and I learned many wonderful things in topology from Michael, and I've become fascinated with this subject. As much as Michael is becoming more confident as a condensed matter physicist, I'm making my first step as a topologist. And maybe... yeah. And maybe at some point we'll switch places, but better yet... yeah. Better yet, we will invent... a wild mix of physics and topology that has not been seen before. And Michael also led me on a few hikes. It was challenging, but a lot of fun. And I want to tell you about one particular challenge last summer in Aspen. We went to mountains, and Michael told me to leave home at 2 a.m. Being a messy person, I'm not used to getting up at 2 a.m. I rather go to bed at 2 a.m. yeah, but it was necessary to avoid being caught in a thunderstorm on the top of the mountain, and it worked great. We have a wonderful day. We just missed the rain on the summit. Or rather, the nature was kind to us. And we even returned when it was light. I have many other good memories, but I must stay on topic. So let me mention one thing that is directly relevant to my talk. Some 11 years ago, I was working at Microsoft at Redmond, Washington, with Michael, and we took a flight to another Washington. And in the plane, Michael explained to me the classifying spaces and the infinite join construction. I was struggling to understand what a join was at that time, but finally. I understood that, and I really appreciate that. Today, I want to show that I'm good. I'm a good student, and can make Michael's lesson into something new. So, I'll talk about application of homotopy theory in the classification of physical systems, gap topological phases. It's actually not something that has been done. It's yet to be done. So I'll just present some general approach and some insights, and I owe you concrete results. So it's about classifying topological phases. And there are two types of topological phases. One type is with long-range entanglement. And examples are the Torrey code. And the Levin-Wenn model. And another class of phenomena is without long-range entanglement, but with gapless edge modes. And we know lots of examples with non-interacting fermions, like integer quantum Hall effect, topological insulators, topological superconductors, Majorana wires, and so on. And we know some examples with interactions, like AKLT. There are physical systems that have both features, both long-range entanglement and gapless edge modes, like fractional quantum Hall effect. And from the field theory perspective, this thing is topological quantum field theory. And that thing is related to anomalies. and the thing in the middle has both. Somehow, this seems too difficult to handle for me. So I'll focus on that part. And let me explain why. In two dimensions, we can hope in principle to understand topological quantum field theories and possibly all gapped phases. In three dimensions, there is little hope because John Preskill showed us an example of this quantum code by Ha. And there are other codes like by Bravi and Terhal. And excitations in those codes, these are basically gapped Hamiltonians, and excitations are nothing like quasi-particles. Excitations form some strange patterns that cannot move arbitrarily. And it's like wildness in topology. In two dimensions, we can embed a circle, and we can understand it easily. In three dimensions, one can embed a sphere in non-trivial ways like the Alexander sphere, and there is a continuum or a contour set of possible embeddings, and we'll soon get lost in that. So let me focus on this part. How do we understand this class of systems? They are characterized by the lack of long-range entanglement. So all entanglement should be short-range. But still, there is some potential for topology. Let's think about one example of such system, a generic example. It's the free fermion Hamiltonian. In this example, if this matrix is gapped, then one can calculate the expectation values of AJ dagger AK. It's PKJ, where P is the spectral projector. And if the Hopping is short-ranged, and the Hamiltonian is gapped, and then these matrix elements are also short-ranged, and this local information defines the global state. So that's a good example. Now, let me give you a counterexample. It's a toric code or any state with topological order. In the toric code, if we consider a set of disks and specify the reduced density matrix for each disk, rho d, that will actually define the state because the disk may be taken long enough to contain the stabilizers. However, if we do those disks along along a circle, this kind of annulus geometry, there may be some topological charge trap inside. And the reduced density matrices do not define the global state. So the requirement of short-range entanglement is that for each region in the plane or in RD, covering this this region by sufficiently large disks will define the quantum state. Now, we can try to make this requirement more precise, and here quantum information helps. If we have three regions, A, B, and C, we can consider reduced density matrices on each of these regions or on the union, and one can construct the relative mutual information between A and C conditioned on B. Sorry, the conditional mutual information. And rho is the global state. And it's SAB plus SBC minus SB minus SABC. And it's always non-negative. there is a special case when this thing is zero. And that special case is like a Markov chain in the classical case. Let me call it a quantum Markov chain. This condition says that all correlations between A and C are mediated by B. And if B is in the middle, we can expect this is true. For this geometry, this condition actually holds for systems with topological order. However, Levinson and Wen found that in this geometry, this is a hole. This region is called A, C, and B is the union of two regions, and there is nothing inside. In that case, for the toric code, this quantity doesn't vanish. So for this condition to be useful to characterize short-range entanglement, we must consider non-trivial shapes. How complicated do they need to be, those shapes? Let me give you a sufficient condition. We don't have to consider arbitrary complicated shapes. What we need to do is to divide the plane into cells. So, and we can talk about cells in different senses, but this is the simplest construction. We just divided the plane into squares. There are zero cells, one cells, the edges, and the plaquettes are called two cells. Now, I want to thicken those cells. The zero cells will be made very thick. The one cells will be a little thinner, and that is needed so that two one cells do not touch each other. And we'll leave the two cells alone. It's in this case. In the three-dimensional case, we also need to thicken them. So, one particular configuration we need to worry about when stating that condition is this. B will be a K cell. And that cell has adjacent cells of smaller dimension. And that will be called A. And it also has adjacent cells of a larger dimension. And that will be called C. So C is this region on top and on the bottom. And if that condition is true, for all configurations like that, these are local configurations. We don't have to consider big regions. Then we can do the following. We can start building the state from zero cells. And I would just take the product of the reduced density matrices. S is zero. We start building from zero cells. Then this condition intuitively is like a Markov chain. And a Markov chain means that we can organize a random process so that information propagates from lower dimensional cells to high dimensional cells. And that we can do step by step. When we define the state for all zero-dimensional cells, then we need to propagate to one-dimensional cells. And this condition tells us that such propagation is possible. I'll not go into detail, but if the entropy is exactly zero, then we can actually propagate. Now comes a tricky question. What if the conditional mutual entropy is not zero? It's small, but not zero. Because in a real system, we expect exponentially small correlations. Here, we run into an unsolved problem in quantum information, and it seems to be a hard problem. Some very smart people have tried to solve it, but no luck so far. Nevertheless, I believe that if epsilon is small, then this notion is robust enough, and so we can proceed. I'll not dwell on this question, but it may take maybe a few years to solve this problem. I don't know.
You expect if epsilon is so small, then you can define a bigger lattice. Then its epsilon will be smaller.
No. Epsilon will accumulate. Epsilon will, in the worst case, it will add up as the number of cells. I don't expect it to become smaller. So we need this kind of protection. If epsilon is small, then we can approximate this state by a state with the conditional mutual entropy being equal to zero with precision that is logarithmic in dimension, with a factor that is logarithmic in dimension. Because the dimension of the Hilbert space is itself exponential in the number of spins. So now let me formulate a theorem with quotes because it relies on that unproven condition in mutual in information theory. The theorem says this. Suppose we have some state, psi, and let me use two notations. Psi just like that, and as a cat psi, it's in the Hilbert space H. And psi bar is like a bra state. It's in the dual Hilbert space. These are like a system and its time conjugate. Now, if we imagine these are two quantum Hall planes, we put them on, next to each other, and they effectively annihilate. It means that these two systems can be continuously deformed into a product state. So the claim is that psi tensor psi bar is equivalent to 0 tensor 0 bar, where 0, 0 tensor 0 bar. 0 is a trivial state. So let me show you how it works for free electrons and for zero-dimensional systems. In the general case, we have to build from cells. So for free electrons, if we have one chain, right? Zero is a product state. It's I must say that I'm talking about spin systems. One can include fermions. One can include symmetries in principle. And in each case, there is a variant of that theorem. In the simplest case, zero is just a bunch of spins, and each spin points up in the up state. And zero bar is basically the same thing, but to make things clean, I make a difference between H and H dual. Basically, we have this state, another state like that. And if we go in the opposite direction, we do a continuous deformation while maintaining that condition, that the conditional mutual information is close to zero. And the state can be deformed to psi tensor psi bar, where psi bar is, and psi are non-trivial states. With this kind of Hamiltonian, let's think about Majorana chains. It seems very plausible that the Majorana fermions at the ends of those chains will cancel each other. How does it work? The first chain has the Hamiltonian matrix H, this matrix. The second chain has the Hamiltonian matrix minus H, the Hopping matrix. And there are some Hopping amplitudes between the two chains. So the overall matrix is like H minus H T T times identity. T is the Hopping amplitude. It's applicable to any free electron systems with any symmetry. But one has to modify it a little bit. Now, the eigenvalues of this matrix are epsilon tilde equals square root of epsilon squared plus t squared, where epsilon is an eigenvalue of H. And if H is gapped, this is also gapped. Now, we can crank up T, and eventually the system will break into dimers between the two chains. So we've effected an adiabatic transformation between two chains and the trivial system. Now, the same can be done in general for any quantum states in dimension zero and short-range entangled states in any dimension. So this is one theorem. Now, I need to talk about a few examples. These examples are like with a symmetry group G, we can have non-trivial examples in dimension D. And D may be 1, 2, and higher. In dimension D equals 1, Shangen Wen showed us the answer to this problem. Non-trivial phases are classified by H upper 2 of G U1. And that is for a finite group. Now, if we replace it with compact, then we need to answer the question, what kind of cohomology we consider? Because the usual algebraic notion of cohomology doesn't care about topology. And the proper definition of this cohomology is actually equivalent to H upper 3 of BG, comma Z. And that works for any compact group. And actually, in any dimension, the answer is HD plus 2 of BG, comma Z. BG is the classifying space. But this is only a partial answer, not a complete answer. Because if we go to dimension 2, we may ignore the symmetry altogether, and still we have a non-trivial example. And that example is the E8 phase. And we also say no fermions. What is the E8 phase? One way to construct it, we take an Ising theory. And in the Ising theory, we have anions. They're called sigma and psi. But now we want to get rid of anions. Well, it's weird that I want to get rid of anions. We all love anions. But let's just imagine life without aliens, and we'll beat this problem to death, and in a year we'll want our aliens back. So how do we get rid of aliens? We need to condense them, but they don't just condense. Things change if sigma has some non-trivial, if the fermions have some non-trivial Chern number, then the topological spin of sigma equals e to the 2 pi I nu over 16, where nu is the number of fermionic species. And this is the topological spin of sigma. If nu equals 16, then the topological spin is 1, and particles can condense. Actually, this system has two flavors of sigma, two types of sigmas. It's called epsilon and m, like in the Torrey code. And we can condense one of those. And psi will become confined, and there'll be no anions at all. However, the bulk will carry gapless mode with central charge C minus equals 8. And if one does the condensation construction in terms of the CFT, it's un-orbifolding. It's the reverse of orbifolding. We actually get the E8 lattice, free boson compactified over E8.
Why sigma is split into two in E and M?
Oh, that just happens. When nu is even, it always splits into two. You can figure it with the pentagon equation.
There's an eighth you can use in eighth U1 gauge field.
On a lattice.
To define a Trin-Simon theory.
Yeah.
Coefficient is this matrix, which is how we describe this root lattice.
Oh, I see, I see. So, yeah. That's a different way to make it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. This is a non-trivial example. It looks like a gravitational anomaly because it's related to the central charge. I'm not sure if it's exactly a gravitational anomaly because anomalies are related to symmetries. I believe it's something deeper. And it doesn't have to be the same as gravitational anomalies in high dimensions. So I still need to figure this out. Yeah. But we certainly don't have conformal field theory in this general topological setting. We don't even have Lorentz symmetry or even rotational symmetry. We can't put things on manifolds in general. And actually, my approach is vastly different from what physicists usually do. In condensed matter, we usually define a system on a lattice and then repeat periodically. In field theory, people define a field theory that can be put on manifolds. My kind of system cannot be put on a manifold. So I fix cannot in general. Each system is unique. I fix it space Y, and I want to classify systems that live in space Y. And those systems consist of atoms or spins that interact. Y can be a manifold. It can be a non-manifold, a cell complex, like two bubbles stuck to each other. Or the most important example is the D-dimensional disk. I wrote it with a comma because we have the short-range entanglement in the bulk, but the boundary may be messy. It can have a gapless mode. For this system, we want to consider all possible Hamiltonians satisfying the short-range entanglement condition. And all those Hamiltonians or quantum states are equal. I don't want to consider an ensemble where some states are more probable than the others. All the states are equal. And in this situation, we may define a space of all states satisfying the short-range entanglement that lives in a huge space of all quantum states. Everything is exponentially dimensional and actually infinitely dimensional because we can add as many spins as we want. So we define some huge space Fn, which is the space of all states. And we want to understand its topology. Now, F0 is CP infinity. Because this is just the space of quantum states. And it's a quantum state in any dimension. We can also add some symmetry constraint G. And then this will change into space of representations, abelian representations, one-dimensional representations.
What is N?
N is, oh, D, D, sorry, D.
So F0 of G,
you said you're going to get
the space of all of the space of characters of G, is that
the D? Yeah, the space of characters.
So that's the
G0. Oh, yeah, sorry. We have a copy of CP infinity for each representation. That's the answer. For each character. I'm sorry, I'm running out of time. Okay. So, thank you. Now. F1 is actually, F0 is CP infinity, and it's the same as KZ, 2. That's the Ellenberg-MacLane space, and its characteristic property then is that the second homotopy group is equal to Z, and all the other homotopy groups vanish. It's a special example of K pi n, where the nth homotopy group is equal to pi. And note that we're classifying the homotopy type of that space. In physical applications, we're interested in connected components. We're interested in pi 0 of Fn, because that defines distinct phases. But it turns out that understanding high homotopy group may be easier in some cases, and it may give us some insight into the thing we eventually want to know. So let me show you the next example. F1 equals KZ3, F2 equals KZ4 cross Z. Here I am a bit unsure, because that's based on the assumption that the E8 case is the only non-trivial phase, and this Z is generated by E8. We can have any number of copies of E8 plus some trivial phase that is described by KZ, 4. So that's in dimension.
Not modding out by something like bosons on the leaf lattice? No.
Just that. Well, I'm not sure. As I say, I don't have a proof. But we don't have real bosons like in field theory, because it's not really a field theory. It's a very coarse definition. We identify many phases because we only care about homotopy. So In high dimensions, things get more complicated. Now, I can make two claims about those spaces. One claim is that Fn is the loop space of Fn plus 1. So that those spaces form a spectrum in the homotopy theory sense. I'll not prove that, but the proof basically uses that theorem about cancellation between psi and psi bar. Let me explain why it is a natural property. If we consider an n-dimensional phase and a domain wall between two phases, phase 1 and phase 2, such domain walls are classified by pi 0 of Fn. On the other hand, we can consider a defect of codimension 2 in an n plus 1 dimensional space. Its dimension is the same as here, n minus 1, but codimension will be 2 rather than 1. And this theory the theorem implies that pi 0 of Fn equals pi 1 of Fn plus 1. So the defect classification depends on the dimension, but not on the codimension. That's why this property is natural. Oh,
there is no defect that cannot be realized in the equal to n case, but it can be realized in the equal to n plus 1 case.
Oh, I can prove that modular that assumption in information theory.
Sorry, it seems that defects between two spaces should be pairs of points, pairs of connected components.
Pairs of connected components. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm skipping some additional structure. The connected components form an abelian group because we can stack them.
Okay. Yeah. And what's the argument that's pi 1 of n plus 1?
That's a special case of the general statement. No, it's not a proof. It's a kind of physical demonstration that this equality makes sense. But
what was the demonstration?
The demonstration is that let's consider d equals n and d equals n plus 1, two cases. In the first case, we consider a domain wall between two faces, and it's described by this thing. In the second thing, we consider a codimension 2 defect, and that's described by that thing. We go around the defect. And this is claim 1 and claim 2 that I'm slightly less sure about this claim, but I can only prove it one direction, that if we add symmetry, it's the same as considering maps from BG to Fn. So symmetry can be replaced by a homotopy theory argument. And let me show how it works. Say for n equals 1. Maps of BG, F1 is over there, it's KZ3, and it's the same as H upper 3 of BG. So we reproduce the previous result, about 1D chain, and it's actually an established result. If we go higher in dimension, we'll see other things. Let me show you how to get a mixed anomaly. Well, we have some analog of gravitational anomaly. It's this Z. If we set G equals U1, N equals 4, then let's talk about maps of BU1 to F2. And conjecturally, F2 is made of delooping this, this space twice. It's K Z comma 6 cross K Z comma 2. And when we consider maps from BU1 to this is CP infinity, by the way, to this space, here we get H upper 6 of BU1 Z, and there we get H upper 2 and since this part came from that Z, and that Z is sort of gravitational anomaly, we can identify the second factor as a mixed anomaly between U1 and gravity. It seems that this machinery is able to produce some results, and the hardest part is to actually calculate that spectrum. I don't know how to do that in general. My guess is that in high dimensions, we'll be getting an extra copy of Z each fourth dimension, like in dimension 2, 6, and so on. I guess here my knowledge ends. I want to make a final remark. Just a couple of months ago, Michael explained me a new thing in topology. It was about Stinrod squares. And it's a beautiful thing, and he said, I'm sure that you will use that in your next paper. I don't know, I don't know what Michael actually meant, but now I strongly suspect that when we add fermions, the Stinrod squares will inevitably come up. Thank you for your attention. I don't know. I don't know.
How is it related? How is this related to the K-theory classification of these spaces? I heard about earlier.
I don't know yet.
Of course, naturally leads one to think about the K-theory.
Yeah,
which would be twisted products of these island
particles. Right. I think that the Z part will be similar to the K-theory classification. I don't really know. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Let me just ask, in terms of the spectrum, the Z factor.
Mike, hold. Mm-hmm.
In terms of the spectrum, without the Z factors, this is just the spectrum for ordinary integer cohomology.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if the Z factors make any difference in terms of the spectrum.
Oh, you mean these Z factors?
Yeah.
Well, when we deloop it further, they may get entangled with this part. And that I don't know.
Microphone. Yeah, we define this short entanglement using this finite depth quantum circuit. So I want, looks like that definition is stricter than this than your definition.
Well,
so I kind of wonder if using this stricter definition, yeah, what's the relation with your definition? Also, if using stricter definition, whether this Z factor would go away?
Well, everything will go away. Everything will go away because in my definition, there is a class of states and an equivalence relation.
Okay.
The equivalence relation is exactly like your definition. Two states are equivalent if there is an adiabatic path between the two states. That's the same as saying that there exists a short depth circuit to implement the transformation. So in my case, those states will fall into the same phase if they're connected by a circuit. So everything will collapse if I change the definition. Yeah, yeah.
And there are lots of other statements or classifications by these cohomology groups. And now I noticed that these are the same cohomology groups that cannot be classified in certain Simons terms. There's this paper by Dijkhoff and Witten where they introduced Dijkhoff-Witten invariance.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I know about that. Yeah, it's the same argument, basically. I just made it a bit more abstract. However, the reason it's more abstract that it can also capture this thing that doesn't appear in the paper. Although I cannot calculate those extra factors.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any more questions for Alexi?
Okay, well, let's thank him again.